This is the third of five sessions on C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce. And it occurred to me when, as those of you who hear the other two sessions, when I contemplated the theme on earth as in heaven, I knew we wanted to do something in the area of literature, it immediately struck me the value of this book, because as I expected, and in some ways is appropriate, much of the focus would be on the on earth portion of it here. But as I experience the Lord's Prayer from which this was taken, and as I experience my own life and talk to a number of other people, the phrase on earth really has some power for us as we get hold of this phrase, as in heaven. And if we're serious about the prayer, thy will be done on earth as in heaven, it's even more important that we have some sense what heaven's about. Now, both the Old and New Testament, in one sense, are full of it. But it's hard to get a full picture of that unless we have some other contemporary imagination coming forward for us. Would a couple of you mind bringing in some other chairs, if you know where to get some, so we have plenty of places for people to sit? I don't know where they are, but if there are others, that would help. In order to have our life on earth enabled, empowered, transformed, that has to occur by or from and with heaven, which means having a grasp of what heaven is about. And that's what C.S. Lewis sets out to do in imaginary or fantasy way here in this book. Those of you who've been in the other sessions know some of the ways in which that has occurred. The primary vehicle he uses is to describe a hell which is very different from any of the hells that you probably thought about before. Namely, this hell is not full of brimstone and fire. It's a gray, dreary place in which people keep moving farther and farther away from each other because they are so selfishly preoccupied that when anyone intrudes upon someone else's life, they move further away so their selfish preoccupations aren't disturbed. And so hell is this gray, dreary, lonely place where people are spread out. And if you read, go back and read the first couple chapters, you'll see the beautiful imagery of that. But what happens is, these people in this imaginary hell are given an opportunity to take, of all things, a bus trip to heaven. And that is the imagery to get people up into heaven. And the whole point is that C.S. Lewis is trying to get across in the theme, the title, The Great Divorce, is that if you're going to choose heaven, you're going to have to set aside, reject hell. And if you want hell, you're going to get it, but then you're not going to get any of heaven with it. That's the theme that lies behind it. And as these people begin to come into heaven, get off the bus, and those of you with us in the first couple sessions know in this imaginary heaven, what starts to happen is some bright people or solid people start to come to meet them. And they discover that they are ghosts, that is, the people from hell. They are transparent. They can be seen through. And it's a great shock. And plus, they've got some huge changes to go through as they learn to acclimatize themselves to this new heaven. And the rest of the book is the unfolding of these encounters. We've seen two of them already. And we'll see another very, very... It's my second most favorite one in the whole book. The next one we'll deal with tomorrow at 6:15. My second most famous one, the one we're going to deal with today. But one backward look before we go on, and that's because of a beautiful, and for those for whom it's a troubling question, a very profound question, was raised after the session last time, and Fern gave me permission to repeat her question. And I want to use it as a transition to today, because I think for some it will be a helpful transition, not for all. Those of you who have read C.S. Lewis or know this particular book, know that a very high value in C.S. Lewis is placed on human freedom, which also means choice. And in the session last time, we saw with absolute clarity how that choice comes forth. In fact, there was this almost incredible phrase that for some people was a bit of a shock, where George MacDonald, who is the hero for C.S. Lewis and is the bright person that C.S. Lewis encounters, quotes this phrase that's the epitome of the hellish attitude, namely, better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Hell is what we get if we choose to try and run our own life. If we truly want to learn this prayer, thy will be done on earth as in heaven, we will be transformed. And we will learn what it means to serve. Now that involves some choices. And Fern came up with a beautiful question. And she said, you know, this doesn't quite sit right with what I've experienced as a Lutheran. And this is a little bit of an in-house thing, so those of you who aren't Lutheran won't fully grasp it, but you'll grasp it enough that you know it's a common human dilemma. She said, I was told, taught in confirmation from the very beginning of my understanding of human life, in the explanation to the third article of the Creed, that I believe that I cannot, by my own reason or strength, believe in Jesus Christ my Lord or come to Him. But the Holy Spirit calls, gathers, enlightens, and sanctifies the church, and so on. So that doesn't sound like what C.S. Lewis is saying. C.S. Lewis makes it sound like it's our choice. Is that a fair summary, Fern, of your question? And Fern and I talked about that a bit. I'm not sure we came to any resolution, but I thought it was a helpful transition because it's going to come up again in this chapter. And in one sense, it's a mystery that we will not resolve here. But in another sense, the struggle that Fern was having is the struggle of all of us. Namely, the relationship that we enter into every time we pray this prayer. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Because on the one hand, it's the total giving up of ourselves. Thy will be done, not my will. And that phrase for Lutherans in the Third Article of the Creed, I believe that I cannot by my own reason or strength do so, is an affirmation of total grace at its best, saying that God has done this for me. But it's always a retrospective glance. You can only say it afterwards. Because in the process, it's always a human choice, and that's what Fern was struggling with. It's always a human choice. Even when Lutherans and all Christians at their best say that why faith is so important is that what faith does is says that it's not a matter of works righteousness, it's a matter of where we place our confidence, where we place our trust. Who do you trust? Trust yourself, or do you trust God? And that's what faith is a matter of. But what faith and what Fern and I were trying to struggle with is faith itself is a choice. Faith itself is a choice. Even if it's the barest whisper of a wish, it's still a choice to have that wish to believe. And we may want to come back to that later, if some of this intrigues some of you. But you'll see some of this coming forth now. Now to go from that high philosophy back to the immediate sense of what's here in the story. You have a bright person coming from the heights of heaven, coming to welcome a particular ghost who has a particular struggle, which will be identified very quickly. And we need a couple readers. And fortunately, Bob is here. And although George MacDonald has a very brief portion, we'll ask Bob to read that portion. I'll point it out when we get to it. But I do need three other readers. And some of you like to read this kind of dialogue. And if you do, feel free to volunteer. Otherwise, I may just have to call upon you. We need somebody to read the one of the bright spirits, somebody to read the portion of the ghost, and somebody to be C.S. Lewis in these pages. We're going to begin on page 98, by the way. But page 98. Do any of you like to read or have that sense that you enjoy it? Oh, several. Well, Bob, you get to be George MacDonald. We get to that point. Okay. Well, there's several of you. Okay. Let's see. I've already got one place picked out for Ted. There's actually a song in this dialogue, and Ted gets to chant. So will you be the bright spirit? You got it. And who is over here? Was somebody over here willing to read? Fern? Okay. Do you want to be the ghost?
Sure.
You got it. Okay. All right. Let's see. We got... Oh, and we need somebody... We need somebody to read the C.S. Lewis portion when we get to that, too. Who would like to do that? Anyone? You got it when we get to that portion. Okay. Now we're on page 98. Are all of you who wish to be near us, the text near enough so you can see it? If somebody wants to be near a text but are not, can you hold up your hand so you can be near one and then somebody can share with somebody? Okay, so we're all set. Okay, it's the first full paragraph on page 98, and I'll read the editorial portions, and those of you that have the lines, I'll come in at those appropriate places. I saw coming towards us a ghost who carried something on his shoulder. Like all the ghosts, he was unsubstantial, but they differed, the ghosts, from one another, as smokes differ. Some had been whitish. This one was dark and oily. We'll see why in a minute. What sat on his shoulder was a little red lizard, and it was twitching its tail like a whip and whispering things in his ear, in the ghost's ear. As we caught sight of the ghost, he turned his head to the reptile with a snarl of impatience and said,
"Shut up, I tell you,"
he said. It wagged its tail and continued to whisper to her. He ceased, the lizard, snarling, and presently began to smile. No, the ghost did, snarling. That is, the shut-up snarling. Then he turned and started to limp westward, away from the mountains.
"Off so soon?"
said a voice. The speaker was more or less human in shape, but larger than a man, and so bright that I could hardly look at him. Since we got a female here, we're trying to make this female. Her presence smote on my eyes and on my body too, for there was heat coming from her as well as light, like the morning sun at the beginning of a tyrannous summer day.
"Yes, I'm off,"
said the ghost.
"Thanks for all your hospitality. But it's no good, you see," I told this little chap.
Here he indicated the lizard.
"That he'd have to be quiet if he came, which he insisted on doing. Of course his stuff won't do here, I realize that. But he won't stop. I shall just have to go home."
"Would you like me to make him quiet?"
said the flaming spirit, an angel, as I now understood.
"Of course I would,"
said the ghost.
"Then I will kill him,"
said the angel, taking a step forward.
"Look out, you're burning me. Keep away,"
said the ghost, retreating.
"Don't you want him killed?"
"You didn't say anything about killing him at first. I hardly meant to bother you with anything so drastic as that."
"It's the only way,"
said the angel, whose burning hands were now very close to the lizard.
"Shall I kill it?"
"Well, that's a further question. I'm quite open to consider it. But it's a new point, isn't it? I mean, for the moment, I was only thinking about silencing it because up here, well, it's so damned embarrassing."
"May I kill it?"
"Well, there's time to discuss that later."
"There's no time. May I kill it?"
"Please, I never meant to be such a nuisance. Please, really, don't bother. Look, it's gone to sleep of its own accord. I'm sure it'll be all right now. Thanks ever so much."
"May I kill it?"
"Honestly, I don't think there's the slightest necessity for that. I'm sure I shall be able to keep it in order now. I think the gradual process will be far better than killing it."
"The gradual process is of no use at all."
"Don't you think so? Well, I'll think over what you said very carefully. I honestly will. In fact, I'd let you kill it now. But as a matter of fact, I'm not feeling frightfully well today. It would be silly to do it now. I need to be in good health for the operation. Some other day, perhaps."
"There is no other day. All days are present now."
"Get back! You're burning me! How could I tell you to kill it? You'd kill me if you did."
"It is not so."
"Why are you hurting me now?"
"I never said it wouldn't hurt you. I said it wouldn't kill you."
"Oh, I know. You think I'm a coward. But it isn't really that. Really, it isn't. I say, let me run back by tonight's bus and get an opinion from my own doctor. I'll come again the first moment I can."
This moment contains all moments.
Why are you torturing me? You are jeering at me. How can I let you tear me to pieces? If you wanted to help me, why didn't you kill the damn thing without asking me? Before I knew, it would be all over by now if you had.
I cannot kill it against your will. It is impossible. Have I your permission?
The angel's hands were almost closed on the lizard, but not quite. Then the lizard began chattering to the ghost so loud that even I could hear what it was saying. We forgot to have a lizard. Somebody want to be the lizard? You're on.
Be careful. He can do what he says. He can kill me. One fatal word from you and he will. Then you'll be without me forever and ever. It's not natural. How could you live? You'd be only a sort of a ghost, not a real man, as you are now. He doesn't understand. He's only a cold, bloodless, abstract thing. It may be natural for him, but it isn't for us. Yes, yes, I know. There are no real pleasures now, only dreams. But aren't they better than nothing? And I'll be so good. I admit I've sometimes gone too far in the past, but I promise I won't do it again. I'll give you nothing but really nice dreams, all sweet and fresh and almost innocent. You might say quite innocent.
Have I your permission?
Said the angel to the ghost.
I know it will...
Nope.
Oh, sorry.
No. Ghost?
I know it will kill me!
It won't, but supposing it did.
You're right. It would be better to be dead than to live with this creature.
Then I may?
Damn and blast you! Go on, can't you? Get over. Do what you like.
Bellowed the ghost, but ended whimpering.
God help me. God help me.
Next moment, the ghost gave a scream of agony such as I have never heard on earth. The burning one closed her crimson grip on the reptile, twisted it while it bit and writhed, and then flung it, broken back, on the turf.
Oh, that's done for me,
gasped the ghost, reeling backwards. For a moment, and now this is C.S. Lewis, I could not make out anything distinctly. Then I saw, between me and the nearest bush, unmistakably solid, but growing every moment solider, the upper arm and the shoulder of a man. Then brighter still and stronger, the legs and hands. The neck and golden head materialized while I watched. And if my attention had not wavered, I should have seen the actual completing of a man, an immense man, naked, not much smaller than the angel. What distracted me was the fact that at the same moment something seemed to be happening to the lizard. At first I thought the operation had failed. So far from dying, the creature was still struggling and even growing it bigger as it struggled. And as it grew, it changed. Its hinder parts grew rounder. The tail, still flickering, became a tail of hair that flickered between huge and glossy buttocks. Suddenly, I started back, rubbing my eyes. What stood before me was the greatest stallion I have ever seen, silvery white, but with mane and tail of gold. It was smooth and shining, rippled with swells of flesh and muscle, whinnying and stamping with its hoof. At each stamp, the land shook and the trees dindled. The new-made man turned and clapped the new horse's neck. It nosed his bright body. Horse and master breathed each into the other's nostrils. The man turned, flung himself at the feet of the burning one, and embraced them. When he rose from the embracing, I thought his face shone with tears, but it may only have been the liquid love and brightness, one cannot distinguish them in that country, which flowed from her. I had not long to think about it. In joyous haste, the young woman leaped on the horse's back. Turning in her seat, she waved a farewell, then nudged the stallion with her heels. They were off before I well knew what was happening. They were riding, if you like. There was riding, if you like. I came out as quickly as I could from among the bushes to follow them with my eyes, but already they were only like a shooting star far off in the green plain and soon among the foothills of the mountain. Then, still like a star, I saw them winding up, scaling what seemed impossible steeps, and quicker every moment, till near the dim brow of the landscape, so high that I must strain my neck to see them, they vanished, bright themselves in the rose brightness of the everlasting morning. While I still watched, I noticed that the whole plain and forest were shaking with a sound which in our world would be too large to hear. But there I could take it with joy. I knew it was not the solid people who were singing. It was the voice of that earth, those woods and those waters, a strange, archaic, inorganic noise that came from all directions at once. The nature, or archaic nature, of that land rejoiced to have been once more ridden and therefore consummated in the person of the horse. It sang,
"The master says to our master, come up, share my rest and splendor to all natures that were your enemies. Become slaves to dance before you and backs for you to ride and firmness for your feet to rest on. From beyond all place and time, out of every place, authority will be given you. The strengths that once opposed your will shall be obedient fire in your blood and heavenly thunder in your voice. Overcome us that so overcome we may be ourselves. We desire the beginning of your reign as we desire dawn and dew wetness at the birth of light. Master, your master has appointed you forever to be our king of justice and our high priest."
"George,
do you understand all this, my son?"
said the teacher. "Who is C.S. Lewis?"
"Me. I don't know about all, sir,"
said I.
"Am I right in thinking the lizard really turned into the horse?"
"Aye, but it was killed first. You'll not forget that part of the story."
"I'll try not to, sir, but does it mean that everything that is in us can go on to the mountains?"
"Nothing. Not even the best and noblest can go on as it now is. Nothing, not even what is lowest and most bestial, will not be raised again if it submits to death. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. Flesh and blood cannot come to the mountains. Not because they are too rank, but because they are too weak. What is a lizard compared to a stallion? Lust is poor, weak, whimpering, whispering thing compared to that richness and energy of desire which will arise when lust has been killed."
"But am I to tell them at home that this man's sensuality proved less of an obstacle than that poor woman's love for her son? For that was, at any rate, an excess of love."
"You'll tell them no such thing,"
he replied sternly.
"Excess of love, did you say? There was no excess, there was defect. She loved her son too much.
Too little,
not too much. If she had loved him more, there'd be no difficulty. I don't know how her affair will end, but it may well be that at this moment she's demanding to have him down with her in hell. That kind is sometimes perfectly ready to plunge the soul that they say they love in endless misery, if only they can still in some fashion possess it. No, you must draw another lesson. You must ask if the risen body, even of appetite, is as grand a horse as you saw. What would the risen body of maternal love or friendship be?"
But once more my attention was diverted. "Is there another river, sir?" I asked, and that's what we'll deal with on Friday. The paragraph there on page 105 is simply a reference to the first part of this chapter, where maternal love, in its distorted sense, is seen as falsely controlling or attempting to control the child, and that's the contrast. But that particular part you can go back and read for yourself later. I have reread this section probably a dozen times, and it brings tears to my eyes, but the power of what's here and the transforming fantasy is such to strike the reality of all of us. There are a number of things that I want to pick up on in it. But as we've done in other sessions, I'd like to see and hear, first of all, what affects or what, how you responded, what struck you, if there was something that was a question for you, you didn't grasp, something that really hit home to you, anything you'd like to comment on.
I don't quite understand the significance of the lizard and what that represented to its owner or its keeper or whatever.
Who'd like to pick
sure
up?
Symbolism there.
Who'd like to pick up on? Well, what does the lizard symbolize? Very specifically in this chapter, although it's much broader than that, but very specifically in this chapter, it's lust. In this chapter, it's lust. But read in place of lust, if you will, anything in your life that needs to be taken away from you, killed, to use the beautiful imagery here, or actually the beautiful imagery of the New Testament in reality.
So the lizard could be addiction then. Just
addiction. Oh, you got it! Anything. In the book, it's specifically lust, but anything that you need to be freed from. Maybe it is only a very petty jealousy. Isn't that the way jealousy talks in our ear? So, good question. It really represents lust. Good. I'm glad you brought that up. Other questions like that or comments will help us get into what's being said here and the power of this imagery. Okay, hang on. Yeah.
The thing that struck me that is, in order to have new life, there needs to be death.
Yeah. We've known that. I mean, if you've been in the church at all, you knew that. If you've been baptized, you know that. We need something to jar our imagery. We need something to jar our senses to retell us that. Because even we who are baptized, and if some of you here are not baptized, we'll bless you. Maybe someday that will occur too. We get so content with where the processes are going. And we keep saying, like the ghost kept saying, can't we put it off? Well, I think I'll get a second opinion.
I'll quit tomorrow.
Yes! Yeah. Well, that jealousy, I mean, that, I deserve to have that jealousy. Yeah, all those things. Okay, yeah. That a death is involved. The seed cannot grow until it's put into the ground. And when you put it in the ground, it looks like death. See, it was planted out in front of Narnia. The last couple days. Looks like death. But it can't grow. It can't do a darn thing until it's put there into the ground. Yeah, come on.
Part of the baptism imagery of death has been gone. We go back to the Eastern churches in the old days when they immersed the babies, when they sealed the mouth and the eyes and everything and put the child totally under the water. There was a far more symbolic thing of death there than we see normally.
Yeah, right on. Yeah. Some churches, Lutheran churches, recently have gone to the Saturday night before Easter as a time for baptism as part of the effort to recover some of that symbolism. Yeah. And that's why the Baptists also say that they have it all over all of us Lutherans. Come on, be with it, they say to us Lutherans. I don't know, I like infant baptism, but I can see what they're talking about. Yeah. Okay, turn to page 100. We'll go back and pick up some of the phrases and the power of what's in there. We've already mentioned part of the top of the page on 100. The gradual process is no use at all, says the shining spirit, top of the page. Right down the next paragraph, there's no other day. All days are present now. Now, that's the imagery of heaven. But the whole point is, heaven and hell are present for us here now. Those of you who have some history and theology know Paul Tillich's marvelous series of sermons called The Eternal Now. It's the same point. You cannot escape the present. We try to, but the moment is here. There is no other day. All days are present now. Today is the day of choice. This moment, down a little bit further, this moment contains all moments. That's the power. How are we going, how are you and I going to be transformed so we can do peace and justice and love and mercy here on earth? How? How? The world cries out for it. Our souls cry out for it. From my experience, it's in getting hold of this kind of stuff. The next paragraph after the sentence, this moment contains all moments. What is our usual complaint to God when we finally get the message that something's got to change? Well, you're tormenting me, God. You're jeering at me. If I let you do that, you'll tear me to pieces. Now, Fern, to get back to your point we were raising earlier. If you really wanted to help me, why didn't you kill the damn thing without asking me? Right. The cry of the human soul. I will give up my freedom. I will give up human freedom. That's what we'll say in our enslavement. But God won't have us that way. The absolute glory, beyond any of our present conceiving, I'm convinced, of the gift of freedom, that God created you and me so wonderfully that he will not take that gift of choice away from us. God wants our love, but he wants it to be our choice to love. God wants us to shed everything, but he's not going to tear it away from us. God will tear it away when we give permission. Will it hurt? Sure it'll hurt. But did you notice it won't kill you? Maybe it'll give you new life. It's the whole point there. Then he goes on to say, would have all been over by now if you had. Well, that's true. We would have been a race of machines, not free human beings. The next phrase at the bottom, page 100. I cannot kill it against your will. It is impossible. Have I your permission? And that, Fern, is part of the mystery. Because after the operation's over, the soul comes back and says, I could not have done that by my own power and strength. That's the power of the Holy Spirit operation within me. But at the moment, it's the soul's decision. And that's the every new moment that comes back when we're confronted with these things. Okay, page 101. Did you hear there how the lizard tries to convince of the reality of that particular form of evil? In the middle of that first paragraph, the lizard says, I know there are no real pleasures now, a final acknowledgement that some of the real pleasures are over. And the evil attempts to hold on, the jealousy, the lust, the temptation. We've all been around people or things who are temptations to us. And we have to turn around to see how we can be around people so that we are temptations to others. And when we are trapped in that evil, or the other person who is a temptation to us, and when they realize, or we realize the battle is lost, don't you start this kind of pleading, I'll be better, I admit sometimes I've gone too far in the past. Take addiction. Anybody who's had anything to do with any kind of addiction, and God be praised, finally we're also seeing addiction as a whole bunch of additional things in addition to drugs and alcohol, a whole bunch of other things. But the person caught in that trap says, don't kill me, hang on. I don't have to let go of the addiction, I'll be better. I promise I won't do it again. I'll give you really nice dreams. All sweet and fresh and almost innocent. At least the honesty to say almost innocent. Then, why the simplest or most elemental wish becomes important. What's the final prayer of the ghost? Fern read it beautifully at the bottom of 101. Do what you like, bellowed the ghost, but ended whimpering quite. God help. God help me. Now, any soul who has struggled with the power of evil knows the potency of that prayer. You finally can do nothing else than in the interior of your soul say, God help me. I don't know any other way out. If you do, speak up. Maybe there is another way out. It's that final prayer. And you know what occurs inside the mystery of us at each moment is somehow or other the repetition of that process. God help me. God help me. You're at your wit's end. You're at your emotions end. You're at your relationship end. And something in you cries out, God help me. The answer may not be as immediate as this. In fact, it rarely is dramatic. But it is there. The answer is there. Yeah, thanks for opening the window. I was getting this stuff if you want. Now, there are some times in which those radical changes have to occur. And anyone who's been a part of some kind of more dramatic addiction, rather than the less dramatic addictions, know that sometimes these radical changes have to occur. And by the way, that's a reason of why sometimes the more radical addictions, if one can be cured of them, are the less soul-threatening. Because the less obvious addictions we go through in life, we won't see the need for the radical surgery. Think about the less obvious addictions in your own life and whether you're willing to let this process occur. Now, page 102. What do you think about this? Have you ever conceived of this before? That this heaven, this image of heaven, is really for the people who will have a transformation of everything? What bothers you most? Is it lust? That's the analogy, that's the lesson in this particular one. That if you're willing to let lust go, it'll be transformed in the most beautiful of all love. Lust destroys relationships. But when lust is pulled out, it grows back into the most beautiful relationship. Ask any couple that's been married for a while. They'll tell you. Ask any adolescent, and they don't know yet. No way to know. Right? I don't know. Maybe my adolescent was screwy. I didn't know in adolescence. All I knew was lust. Maybe some of you had a more blessed adolescence than mine. I don't know. But don't get caught only in lust. Take anything that's going to be transformed. And it can be transformed. Maybe some of you think of it, and maybe you'd want to. You don't have to. But if any of you would like to share an example that you know of in somebody else or maybe in yourself where something that was an enemy is a proper enemy gets transformed. Interesting. Try and stretch your imagination a bit. And how is it? If this fantasy here of C.S. Lewis is true, and I think it's profoundly true, then stretch your imagination a bit of how those things in our life which are enemies can be, by God's grace, by God's power, changed and inherit the kingdom of heaven as fellow creatures, as fellows with us. Maybe it's an emotion. Just take jealousy. If jealousy can get transformed within us, actually, it's a beautiful emotion to use to talk about the transformation, because jealousy at its worst at the human level destroys the relationship, right? What is jealousy transformed? Think of the Old Testament. What's that beautiful phrase? I, the Lord your God, am a jealous. Now, what's right about that kind of jealousy? What's right about that kind of jealousy? I, the Lord your God, will not have you subject to other gods. I will not have you succumb to evil. I will you to have good. I'm a jealous God. I know it's for Bruce Johnson's own good. I know it's for Bob Nairn's own good. That you not have other gods. I am jealous for you, Bob Nairn. I'm jealous for you, Fern Blake. And human jealousy, when it's transformed, has that same kind of power to it. You do not want, take the immediate example, you do not want your spouse subverting him or herself to other values. A parent does not want a child subverting themselves. It's the proper jealous love of a parent. But that's only when it's transformed. You give up the jealousy. And if we'd read the stuff in the first part of the chapter, you'd see the exact same kind of thing. False parental love would enslave. Proper parental love frees because it desires to free the person from evil onto the power of God. And that's what this image of the lizard transformed into the stallion. And the poor whimpering soul that doesn't want to give up the lizard rides off into the further depths of even more beautiful heaven on this new stallion. Some of the most beautiful imagery in literature. Did any of you catch, bottom page 103, did any of you catch the allusion, Ted, thanks for nice chanting on that stuff. Did any of you catch the allusion? What reference did that song come from? Did any of you catch that? It is almost a direct rephrasing of Psalm 110. It's right here, first four verses of Psalm 110. It's a masterful rephrasing. Go back some time and have this book with you and have Psalm 110 in front of you. Let's take it apart because that song is so powerful. Sometimes difficult to get hold of the psalm itself. In most versions, the psalm begins, "The Lord said to my Lord." If you know the psalms and all that language. And so you have to catch what's happening. In that phrase, in the scripture, it has to do with whether or not, and Jesus refers back to it. You remember the New Testament? Do you really understand what David was saying there? David was referring to me. And here, now this is nature singing, okay? You remember this? This is transformed nature singing this hymn. All of nature rejoices that that lust was killed and transformed into this stallion. So all of nature sings. This is nature singing now. Nature rejoicing that a human being would allow themselves to be transformed. Now there's a new imagery. Nature singing that a human being would allow themselves to be free. Huh? Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And up here you can begin to appreciate some of that. So, here it is. It sang, "The Master says to our Master." Who's the Master and who's our Master here? This is nature singing. "The Master says to our Master." Do you get the allusions here? Who's the Master and who's our Master?
God is our Master.
God the Creator is the Master. Abba Eva. Abba Ema, whatever the phrase is. The Our Father. That's the Master. And this is nature. So nature says the Master, namely the common Master of human and nature, says to our Master. And who's the Our Master here?
The ghost.
The transformed ghost. Precisely. Oh, exactly. That's the beauty of it, okay? God, this is nature saying, God says to our Master, the transformed ghost, who has been transformed and begins to ride the horse, okay? Come up, nature says that this is what God is saying. Come up, share my rest and splendor till all natures that were your enemies become slaves to dance before you and backs for you to ride. Oh, wow, that's kind of stuff transforms me. I don't know about you. You may not be as enjoying the literature and poetry, but that's, and firmness for your feet to rest on. All those things that would oppose you can be included. I got to go back. Maybe it didn't hit you in some way. You remember Scott asked you a sermon the opening night? Be careful to include your enemies in your prayers. And your enemies are not just another nation or somebody who's out to kill, but those things within you that oppose you. Those are the enemies that you have to attend to as part of being able to be freed up to do peace and justice and love and mercy on earth. You've got to attend to those internal enemies, or you're going to come out there a hypocrite. You're going to come out there subverting the various things that you attempt to deal with. And then if you allow all this to happen, your enemies become slaves to dance before you and backs for you to ride and firmness for you to ride up from beyond all place and time, out of the very place, namely ultimate heaven, authority will be given to you. The strengths, get this, the strengths that once opposed your will shall be obedient fire in your blood and heavenly thunder in your voice. What do we most want in daily life? One other way to say it is to have that obedient fire in our blood and heavenly thunder in our voice. Now, if the imagery bothers you, don't get lost in it. But what does a parent desire in relationship to a child but to have heavenly thunder in their voice? I mean, change the imagery if you want somehow, but that's the whole point. You want to take those desires in yourself that would falsely enslave the child and have it be transformed. In your relationships at work, in your relationships wherever they are, you want that kind of transformation to occur. Then, the marvelous phrase, overcome us that so overcome we may be ourselves. We desire the beginning of your reign as we desire dawn and dew, wetness at the birth of life. Is it better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven? We desire your reign. Thy will be done. We desire your reign. Overcome us so that overcome we may be ourselves. Ferna goes right back to the great question you raised. The very will that we have needs to be overcome that it can learn its proper place. In its proper place is this prayer, Thy will be done on earth as heaven. The control, I must submit my will to God's will. It has no other place in creation. If I do not, it becomes distorted. It becomes all these other things that occur. And that's what this rephrasing of Psalm 110 is all about. What does all that say to all of you? I'm maybe just blathering away up here. Is it where does it strike you? Is it on target? Is it off target? Is it useful? Non-useful?
I often have trouble with the phrase submitting to God's will because it has been used by so many various religions and things.
To enslave.
Slave.
Precisely.
Go to war because it is God's will.
Oh, right, right, right on. Yes. And if we could catch hold of some of the beauty of what's being seen here, the individual soul, as it encounters God, there's no other choice. But it gets subverted so quickly. We human beings so quickly turn it to selfish ends. People on the opposite sides in war praying to God. Or somebody else. You know, how do you be a friend to somebody when you have the sense that maybe you know what God's will is for that person? Well, they're not going to hear it. You have to find some way, deed of love or justice or forgiveness to help them hear it. And you risk, if you try to impose it, they'll resist. That's the great difficulty in either evangelism or social justice. It's the same difficulty. Now, In civil justice, it's a little easier because you can punish somebody for a crime. And I think certain types of punishment are quite appropriate. In my mind, they ought to be in the terms of recompense for the crime that's committed. And our criminal justice system is so far away from that, we could spend a whole hour on that whole subject if someone could be started on that. But in the rest of life, it's extremely difficult to find how you can make justice and mercy fit in a given situation that doesn't become the submission of another person's soul. Yeah, right on. Yeah. But that too then becomes analogy for the struggle in our own soul. It's so difficult. to give up our own claim. But we've known that. Again, you go back to the very beginning. We've known that all our lives. That we must give up life in order to inherit life. And as came out in the session yesterday, beautifully said. Who was it said it? Somebody said it. The insight that you get that when the Lord says, greater love has no person than what?
You lay down your life.
Lay down your life for another person. And the insight that, in addition, that you give your life that another person might live, that's your life you're gaining at the same time. And yet how much we resist. Oh Lord, not that, not now. No, I expected something more glorious, Lord. If I'm going to give up my life, I want it to be something worthwhile. They'll get some human credit out of it or something. Right? Yeah, that's right on. We resist, both for good and bad reasons. We resist because we see the human subversion of this so readily, all around it. And tragically enough, we see it in the church. And I don't mean to put the church down in the slightest. The church is, in many ways, our mother. Many very, very profound ways. But the institutional church does get screwed up sometimes. But that's nothing new. So do families. So do schools. So you try to find some new birth for all of them. Yeah. Anything else in gnawing away at someone? Question you want to raise? So George MacDonald, this wise old sage, says at the end of this marvelous hymn, "Do you understand all this, my son?" Well, no, I don't think I do. I'm willing to give it a shot. Am I right in thinking the lizard really turned into a horse? Right. Does it mean that everything that is in us can go to the mountains? What was the answer? Nothing, not even the best and noblest, can go on as it now is. The need for transformation. On the other hand, no thing, not even what is lowest and most bestial, will not be raised again if it submits to death. In other words, it will be. It is sown a natural body, is raised a spiritual body. Where is that from? Those of you who know your Bible.
We hear it at our funeral services.
Yeah, right on. And why do we hear it at our funeral services? Right on. Very good. Beautiful. But why do we use it in funeral services? Where does it come from? Good for you. Ta-da. Right. Exactly. We're constantly nourished by our tradition. And sometimes that portion of Corinthians people will poo-poo. Bah, that's not relevant to injustice in Nicaragua, or that's not relevant to ecology problems, or that's not relevant to lost youth, or that's not relevant to marriage problems. It is absolutely 100% relevant, or else C.S. Lewis is screwy and the scriptures are screwy and everything else is screwy.
Bruce, can I switch here a little bit?
Please.
I have a question about the heat felt from the angel to the ghost. What did the heat represent? You know, the ghost is saying, ouch, you're getting too close, you're too hot.
Now that we talked about it a bit, I'd like to hear what some others think of that.
That thing that you presented with the glory of God, you would cringe in terror and say, keep away from me, I can't bear it.
Yeah, right on.
I guess I can see the light is too bright.
The light is too bright, right? That's another part of it, but the heat is also too great.
The refiner's fire.
Oh, right on.
What did you say?
The refiner's fire.
Then say more. Translate that a little bit. Somebody else affirm. Go ahead.
That which is of no avail will be burned up.
Yeah.
And only the pure is left.
Yeah. The dross in us desperately needs to be burned out of us. And why is it heat? Why is it heat? Because we would cling to it so much. And it needs fire to refine it. Yeah, precisely. And this ought not to surprise us either. What does the Lord say to us? Some of you may have to pluck out your right eye and give up your left arm in order to enter the kingdom of heaven. And what is all of this saying here? All of this is saying, if you've got to pluck out your eye, you better do it, because that's where you're going to get in heaven, and that right eye will be restored to you far more beautifully than you can ever examine. One other place I read. Part of the difficulty we have in imagining this. Try to imagine a caterpillar chewing on a leaf and seeing a butterfly overhead. Do you think the caterpillar has the slightest image that one day it'll be a butterfly? Now that's only an analogy. If you don't like the analogy, let it be. But if it speaks to you, we can't now have but the faintest glimmer of what the resurrection life is. But that it is, and it's real, and that it can begin to transform us now is where we begin to get some insight into it. At a funeral service, when it's prayed, and not prayed, when it's quoted, sow in a natural body, raised to a spiritual body. That ought not to be a source of sorrow. It ought to be, at every funeral service, a reminder that that very process, this day, every moment, is the moment of death and resurrection, if we will but have it. We are in the process of being remade. And the thing that's so difficult to get hold of, a word we don't hear much about anymore, it seems to have gone out of style. The great thing about God is the holiness or the fulfillment, and that's because we have such a narrow, cramped view of holiness. But it's the fulfillment of all we've ever wanted. And it's because we have such a dim view, a low view of heaven, that we can't get a hold of that's the soul's deepest longing. That's what we've always wanted. The fulfillment of every relationship, every truth and justice we could want. Notice, what does he go on and say? It's not flesh and blood can't come to the mountains, not because they are too rank. Why? It's because they're not strong enough. They need to be made stronger. Lust is a poor, weak, whimpering, whispering thing compared with the richness and energy that will arise. And then at the bottom of at the last sentence before the last paragraph, you must draw another lesson. You must ask, if the risen body, even of an appetite, and by appetite he's using classic language here, meaning any desire that we have. If the risen body of an appetite, now get what he's saying here, the risen body of that appetite, in this case lust, to substitute any other desire you want, is as grand as a horse you saw, what would be the risen body of maternal love or friendship? Maternal love and friendship on a scale of things are infinitely higher important than lust. But maternal love and friendship also need to be transformed. And if lust becomes a horse, George MacDonald is saying, imagine, try with your imagination, stretch your imagination to its greatest and most powerful. What would those even more precious things in life be? How is maternal love going to show up transformed, and how is friendship going to show up transformed?
In sacrifice.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That's the earthly side of it. You're right on. You're a George MacDonald here today. Yeah. Okay, well, we're within 1 minute of being out of time. And tomorrow at 6, if you will have it, and if you can believe it, there's even better stuff coming. Sometimes I think how can C.S. Lewis continue to outdo himself, but he does. And we'll get more of Bob Nair's reading, because there's more lines for George MacDonald tomorrow. So So it is 5, and we do need to stop so another class can be in here. If you have more questions, I'm happy to take time. Well, wait a minute. I'm on the dish team. Talk about service. I'm supposed to go be on the dish team. So if you want more conversation, I'd be delighted to have with you after supper, but I got to go be on the dish team.